Hello and welcome to Dairy Digressions, the new podcast of the American Dairy Science Association. I'm Dr. Matt Lucy, Editor-in-Chief of JDS Communications, and I'll be your host. On this podcast, we will speak with some of the top minds in the dairy sciences and explore research, philosophy, and trends in their respective fields. If you enjoy Dairy Digressions or have feedback for us, please let us know at adsa@adsa.org. And make sure to like, subscribe, and rate us on whatever platform you're listening on. Today, we have with us Dr. Jenny Price from Agricultural Victoria and La Trobe University in Bundoora, Victoria, which is a suburb of Melbourne. And we're going to talk all things dairy genetics. Welcome, Jenny, to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Great to be here today.
You know, Jenny, you know what we're going to do? We're going to start out with a short sort of introduction of you, the mysterious Jenny Price. And we have to, I got to know you back and I originally met you in a conference in Ireland. And I don't think you're Irish, but so where were you born?
Just over the ditch, actually. So I was born in the UK on the English-Welsh border. So Celtic origins.
Is that right? Okay. Do you still carry an English passport or no?
I do, but I've been collecting passports around the world. So I've now got three. I've lived in UK, New Zealand, Australia.
Yeah, you've been around and I think I've seen you in almost every one of those places. Okay, so tell me. So let me guess, you grew up on a dairy farm. There was one cow out there in the barn and that's how you got interested in dairying, or what is the history here?
That's pretty much it. I think, like a lot of people, I got really passionate about the dairy industry when I was a kid. I got into it through showing dairy calves. And
no way.
Yeah. And my dad actually gave me the daughter of the calf that I came fourth with in the All Britain Calf Show when I was 11 years old. And she became the mum of my very own dairy herd. And after that, I guess I became pretty interested in genetics and more specifically how to breed great show calves.
Oh, that is fantastic. So when you went as an undergraduate, you went to college.
Yeah.
And where was that?
I went to University of Edinburgh and I chose it specifically because of dairy genetics. So they had this amazing Lang Hill experiment, which was two selection lines for two different diets. And, you know, I had that as my goal and I ended up working there and also doing my PhD there, which was really fantastic. So I'm probably one of those weird people who started off with a goal and it's played out for me.
Yeah, that's almost unheard of to like as a kid from a town in England to say, I think I'm going to go to school for genetics and then hang in there through your PhD.
Exactly. Yeah. But I wouldn't have ever imagined that I'd be, you know, in the position that I'm in Australia. You know, I think that's pretty incredible.
So what was your first professional position after all that?
So when I finished my PhD, I worked for a few years in Edinburgh for SRUC. Or SAC as it was back then, Scottish Agricultural College. I think it was around then that I met you for the first time, Matt, and yeah. I was talking about some of the ways we could genetically improve fertility of dairy cows.
Yeah, you have to understand, I have with me, Jenny, just in case you don't have a copy, okay? The 26th British Occasional publication, I think it was published in 2001 from that conference in Ireland, yeah. Right? And in there, you wrote a paper and you made a presentation on genetic selection for fertility. And I think maybe not among, at this point in time, back in early 2000s, there was a lot of skepticism about selection for fertility. And there was a lot of little boutique studies going on. And so did you get a lot of headwind when you were talking fertility? I know the Norwegians were doing fertility for a long time, but were you getting a lot of headwinds when you would talk about it or think about it?
Yes, absolutely. And, yeah, being a young female scientist, I have to say that I certainly had more than my fair share of heated debates with people who said fertility, it's all about management and feeding. And I said, there's not a lot of in terms of heritability, but there's actually lots of genetic variation. And, you know, I think it's actually true that selecting for production led to a reduction in fertility, but it's also helped to reverse the fertility issue that we've seen globally. So
it's interesting. So I think that was around 2000. And, you know, now we dial it forward to today where, so for example, in Australia, when you think about your selection indices, what percentage would you, you know, I know there's a lot of ways we define fertility, but what percentages would you put on it in terms of how much is fertility weighted in Australia, at least?
Yeah, and it depends on the, it is actually quite complex because it depends on the index. We've got a few different indices that farmers could use. So we do actually have one that is more weighted towards fertility for farmers who have a specific concern. But there's also different ways of calculating the emphasis as well. And one is more around the sort of response that you might expect. And I think that's probably the most accurate way of quantifying it. But it's typically in the region of around about 10% or so.
Yeah. Okay. So we've gone from it's a ridiculous idea to a 10% weighting in significant, you know, important dairy industries as you have in Australia. So the now I don't know how long you were where, but I know you ended up at LIC, which is Livestock Improvement Company, of course, the major bull stud in New Zealand. And how long were you there?
I was there for about 7 years. There's a really great R&D group there. So it was a great experience for me. And I learned a lot about a very different system as well, you know, coming from the UK to the grazing type of system that they have in New Zealand. So it was a fantastic time.
Yeah. Did your family beg you not to go so far away, or what was the story with that?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting story. So one of my PhD supervisors, the late Bill Hill, said to me on a number of occasions, why didn't you think about spreading your wings a little bit and trying somewhere else? And I don't think he really meant to go to the other side of the world, because he was a little shocked when I told him where I was off to. And I think everybody thought that I was going to be down this part of the world for a few years, not over 20.
Yeah. Yeah, my son just moved to Christchurch, New Zealand. Just got married and he moved to Christchurch. He's an engineer. And so it's a long way away.
It is a long way.
It's a long ride. It's a long ride.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I don't know if you moved from there to this Latrobe. Don't know. Was there something between Latrobe and LIC or no?
No. So there's two, I suppose, really great geneticists working in Melbourne, Mike Goddard and Ben Hayes, and they'd invented this thing called genomic selection with Theo Muesen from Norway. And it was pretty much the place to be. And I decided that it was a really great opportunity. Ben asked me if I was interested in coming over here, and I really jumped at the chance. And I'm also a bit of a tennis nut, so, you know, being here for the Aussie Open is pretty good too.
Yeah, they have it must be at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, or is that?
Yeah, close
the
to
MCG,
there.
Right?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, close to there. There's the tennis as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Aussie rules football for you as well, or no?
Not so much on the Aussie rules football. I just stick to the tennis.
So with the tennis, it's interesting you bring up the genomics and the genomic selection and how much they changed dairying. And I'll never forget that, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about whether or not we should even invest in sequencing, well, probably the human genome, but certainly the bovine genome. And I remember it might have been when you were at LIC that the Kiwis were going to invest a significant amount of money. And I remember the Americans were like, well, we'll put in $1 million or something, you know, some ridiculously low amount. And look at where we are today, right?
Exactly.
It's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's transformed plant and animal breeding universally. It's been incredible, really, the amount that it's added animal and plant industries worldwide.
The payback of that initial investment, and then, as you know, all the changes in sequencing. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I always tell my freshman dairy science students that, you know, bovine are only second to humans in terms of the amount of genetics and sequencing that goes on. You know, maybe that's not true. I don't know, but makes a good story, right? Yeah. You know, so we do a lot of that stuff. So you got this position, and it seems like it's kind of split across two research organizations. Is that true or false or not?
Yeah, that's right. My main employer is Agriculture Victoria Research, but I do have a joint position with La Trobe Uni, which means that I can supervise PhD students directly, which is great. So the main reason, but it's also good to have that direct link with a university as well.
Do they tag you for any teaching and all that or what?
No, I'm a 100% research position. So also very fortunate.
Can I calm down, please?
It's 100%
research.
Absolutely. So, and we've got a really great team of people who are 100% researchers, and we have a great team of PhD students who are, you know, completely integrated into the team as well. So
I have this vision, okay, and you need to fix my vision, okay? So what percentage of your time do you spend behind a computer screen, your work time?
Pretty much 100%.
That's what you kind of do, right?
Exactly. Unless, you know, I do work from home quite a bit, so that means I up the percentage of computer screen time. But I'm on a lot of meetings as well. So
you love those meetings, I bet. Favorite part of your day, right?
Absolutely. I love it when it's talking science, not so much talking politics.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things. I love to talk science too. And as long as it's science, it's good, right? We all like science, you know, and we find that good. So I was curious just to ask you about how does a geneticist like yourself kind of organize your laboratory in terms of postdocs and students, and for example, and even, you know, technicians? Do you have technicians that do coding for you and that sort of thing? Or can you just describe what a laboratory group might look like for a geneticist?
Yeah, in the genetics world, well, I guess it probably varies by organization. So we're a bit different from a university that we have probably a bit of a larger group. So my role currently, I'm actually looking after our molecular phenomics team as well. So molecular phenotyping. You know, we can look at fatty acids and metabolites in milk, blood, whatever. And we also have molecular genetics. So we've got all of those expensive toys as well on the genomics and the sequencing side. So it's a really large team all up. But if we focus in on the genetics side of the team, we call the team computational biology because we are a bit broader than just genetics. So they are typically 100% connected to our supercomputers, and they are self-motivated coders using all sorts of different ways of analyzing data and structuring data. So, you know, we work with really massive data sets, like full sequence data on thousands of animals with matching phenotypes.
So this sounds like this is all dedicated to dairy, this huge effort all dedicated to dairy in Australia.
Absolutely.
What? Yes.
Yeah, we have
how many cows do you have in Australia?
Yeah, we have about 1.5 million dairy cows currently. Ah. So, but we do have an issue with the genotype bioenvironment interaction. So because of our grazing systems, you know, it's different to the sort of genetics that comes out of North America and Europe. So, you know, many of those bulls that come from North America and Europe rank really highly in our system, but we need to make sure that we have the most appropriate genetics for Australia. So that's basically what we do, is just to make sure that anything that gets used by Aussie dairy farmers is appropriate for the sort of systems they're operating.
Yeah. I would just suggest buy, you know, American genetics and just go with it. You know what I mean? What do you think, Jenny? Just go American. USA. USA, right?
There are some farmers who are very passionate about using North American genetics, for sure. But I think the majority of them want to know that they are going to get cows that perform well in their environment. Funny you should say the USA, that we developed a heat tolerance breeding value
a
few years ago.
Excellent.
And that was, you know, looking at the reduction in yield as cows experience more hot and humid conditions. And we worked with Pete Hansen's group, University of Florida, to validate in a very large Californian dairy herd. And the results were just fantastic, that we were seeing differences in core body temperature between cows that were high and low breeding value, even in the US system. So, which is quite fascinating. So, yeah.
That was excellent work. And I remember you talking about it and the derivation of that. And I don't think they've put that into ours, at least net merit. I don't think they've tried to stick that into net merit
yet. No.
But, you know, it's coming, right? And I think this might be a little bit off topic, but I think we're getting to the point where, and maybe I'm wrong, but there's so many good traits out there, so many new discoveries, that how do you piece them together, and who do you, if I put in heat tolerance, I'm going to have to take out something or reduce the weight on something else, right? And that's a tough
exactly.
one, isn't it?
And if you're in a cooler climate, you may not see the value in heat tolerance. So it's quite a difference, I guess, for Californian farmers versus farmers in Wisconsin, for example.
Yeah, for sure, right? I think that's kind of where we're at, you know, and that becomes an interesting, I guess, when you talk about selection indices, then that's all based on what is the value of a trade and how do you calculate the value of the trade? And I don't think you're in the business of calculating the value of traits. And sometimes I sort of kind of smile when people even, it's a difficult calculation to make, right? The value of a trait and the versus the value of another trait, right?
Yeah.
And it's a very tough one.
We put a lot of effort into calculating the value of those traits, and to get
and
to get those selection indices, I guess, most aligned to farmer profitability or whatever the objective might be. But, you know, the thing is, I think that it kind of comes out in the wash that if you get the economics right, then you get the emphasis on each of those traits in the right ballpark. And then if your overall objective is profitability, then all of those individual components should hopefully add to greater profitability. So, you know, it becomes a bit questionable when you have traits that are of small economic value as to whether it's worth including in the index, or with the heat tolerance example of it's very valuable for some farmers but less valuable for others. But that's part of the challenge, and I think that's going to be a leading challenge going forward, in addition to trying to, you know, automate a lot of the ways that we're measuring these new traits as well. I think that's going to be a big game changer.
Yeah, more data, right? It's interesting how our lives have changed, right? Just in our lives, how our lives have changed. And in terms of, I mean, I always tell people that have there ever been a greater 50 years in science than the last 50 years? And, you know, there's been a lot of good science in the history of humankind, right? But has it ever more happened than in the last 50 years? And of course, as you know, I was talking to a student yesterday and she was asking me for advice. And I said, well, whatever you do, you need to be able to handle big data sets, because regardless if you're a physiologist, a geneticist or whatever, those come back into your lap, and the people that are going to do, the scientists that are going to do well in the future can handle large data sets. And I always tell them not in Excel files either. I mean, you need to be able to, like, program, you know, you got to be able to program. So anyway, so we've talked a little about the dairy industry, and I know that Australia had some bad times with the drought, and I don't know if you lost cows or gained cows during the drought, but what, and I think the drought's over, but maybe you can correct me, but what are farmers talking about now? What's on their minds in Australia right now, the Australian dairy farmer?
Yeah, we've had a lot of variability in climate. So, for example, down here in Victoria, we had a really wet spring and start, a late start to our summer. So, you know, feed supply was pretty short. And, you know, and I think the global issue of inflation and interest rates is now probably the crunch point for many dairy farmers worldwide, actually. So that those are the sorts of things I think our farmers are talking about. Fertility is still very high on the agenda, but I think climate variability and what we can do to resolve those climate issues is actually starting to become more common in our discussions in terms of how we can help from a research perspective, especially.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. I would agree that in the United States, what we've seen, you know, farmers would always talk about the price of milk, labor, and then repro. That was always something that was on their mind, getting their cows pregnant, you know. And I asked a guy from California, a 3,000 cow dairy, and I said, he owned a 3,000 cow dairy. I said, what's the number one thing you care about right now on your 3,000 cow dairy? He said, water. Water. That's what he cared about. He said, you don't understand. It's all about water right now. And it's quite a shift, right? But that is your comment about climate variability. And they've had a lot of rain out in California now. But, you know, it still doesn't fix the water issues, you know? So in America, I think what we're seeing is, I think the future of the dairy industry is cows are going to move wherever they can get water, you know, wherever you can access water. You don't have that option in Australia. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. It's dry everywhere in Australia, isn't it? Where is it wet in Australia?
Yeah, that's a good question. And what we're seeing actually is a shift south. Because it's the opposite way around, if you think about it. So the south is obviously cooler. So Tasmania is definitely growing in terms of dairy numbers. And we're seeing, like, you know, exactly the same as what you were talking about for California, that our northern Victorian farmers, water is their number one issue. And how long, you know, many of them can hold on for is the question.
Yeah, that is just... anyway, so Jenny, the reason I asked you to present on the podcast, other than you're an old friend, and was that I was reading the Journal of Dairy Science, and you may believe me, but I actually do look at the genetics section. I find it an excellent section in the Journal of Dairy Science. And I saw the paper, your paper, well, it was from your group, Synchronization of Breeding and Its Impact on Genetic Parameters and Evaluation of Female Fertility Traits. And this was authored by, I'm going to do a disaster with the name, but Mekonnen Haile-Mariam? Anywhere close?
Yes, Mekonnen Haile-Mariam.
Irene Vandenberg, Phung Nhi Ho, and yourself. Okay. And
yes.
And of course, the reason I looked at this paper was I remember, you know, we do a tremendous amount of synchronization in the United States, as you know. And I always had this idea or this thought that, not really a concern, but a curiosity, you know, when we apply sort of broadly apply management to dairy cattle and then perform genetic selection, and particularly when this genetic selection is done in a genomic area where we can apply intense pressure, right? And with very short generation intervals, what are the implications of that selection in terms of management? How can management affect the direction that we take a species, for example? And, you know, and I guess to simplify, so for example, if every cow is milked three times a day and we select for milk production, are we selecting for cows that make a lot of milk if they're milked three times a day? And can we expect, if a farmer is milking twice a day, would he receive the same benefit, or would his cows do something differently? And my guess is, I think probably we would argue there's a good genetic correlation between 3X and 2X in terms of genetic selection. So if you get a cow that makes a lot of milk at 3X, she'll probably make a lot of milk at 2X, and who knows with 1X, okay, the once a day, who knows? Who knows about that cow? Yeah. But then I thought about the synchronization, since we would expect 75% to 80% of cows in the United States that are on timed AI programs for first service, and we don't know if we're going to do timed AI forever. In 50 years of genomic selection, will we end up with cows that basically the only way we can, are we selecting a cow that responds really well to prostaglandin and GnRH? And if those things were to go away for whatever reason, a global shortage or whatever reason, that we would have cows that just simply, their fertility isn't as good if they're not on shots, but we've selected us, you know, cows that are good. So I think that's kind of what you were getting at, exactly looking at how the method, the management method in terms of synchronization and timed AI and stuff impacted your genetic selection. So would you like to tell us a little bit about what you found? I think I've kind of there. I don't know.
You've got it really in a nutshell. I think that was a very good explanation actually, Matt. So, you know, and what we, I guess what we found was a lot fewer cows in Australia are synchronized. So we got only around about 11%.
And what, do you need some drugs? Would you like me to send a container ship down there or what? 11%. Oh my God.
Yeah. That was about, what we found. But, you know, it was enough of, well, I suppose widespread enough that we wanted to take a look at it and understand which traits might be affected by synchronization. And the results, I guess, were somewhat unsurprising, that the traits that were associated with conception were still genetically the same, regardless of whether they were under a synchro or non-synchro program. But the interval from calving to first mating was very much affected. So we had a low correlation of around about 0.5 to 0.6, which implies that it's not a good idea to use data from synchronization programs when you're evaluating that trait. So we've developed a method to identify which herds are using synchronization programs, or to roughly work out. And it's really on the basis of the proportion of matings that are on a specific day and whether that follows chi-squared distribution. And once we've identified those herds, we simply just mask the data that comes from those herds for that specific trait. So it's just saying, let's ignore that 11% of the data which comes from synchronized herds just for that one trait.
And so this is important, particularly, I think, when you talk about interval the first service, for example, or interval the first postpartum interval from calving to first service. And oftentimes we associate a better fertility, healthier cow with a cow that has a shorter interval to first service because they're cycling, for example. And cows that are cycling are usually more fertile. And so that's a trait that we've always sort of been loosely associated with fertility. And certainly if you talk about grass-based herds, you know, 21-day submission rates and stuff like that are super important. And, but again, as you mentioned, when we're talking timed AI herds where everybody's going to get inseminated at 60 days postpartum, those data are pretty useless in terms of genetics. Yeah. But other traits are okay. So do you feel, for example, that a cow that gets pregnant on a timed AI program, for example, that there's a decent genetic correlation between a cow that gets pregnant on a timed AI program and a cow that gets pregnant on natural service? So you guys pretty comfortable with those are same traits, pregnancy after insemination, regardless of what happened to the cow leading up to that?
Yeah, exactly. Whether they're on the synchronized program or not, that conception rate trait.
Is that right? No way, really? So, yeah. Okay. So we're safe with that aspect of it.
Exactly. Yes.
Based on how many cows? How many cows did you have in your study?
Well, we started with about 12 million mating records. So your comment earlier about students getting used to handling really big data sets, I think is certainly true, that these are the sort of scale of data sets that we're working with. Now, after we merged it with production data, we actually reduced it quite substantially. So we ended up with about 5 million records from 2 million cows. Yeah.
What about embryonic loss? Do you guys work on embryonic loss and the genetics underlying embryonic loss?
We'd love to, but getting that data at scale is still a bit of a challenge. I think there's been some work, like I can think of some work from mm-hmm. Ireland, for example, where they've looked mm-hmm. at those sorts of traits and being able to get some pretty good data actually on those traits. But it's really, I think this is where we're going to see innovation and technology really giving a helping hand with genomics, is anything that we can measure on a large number of animals reasonably cheaply is a very good candidate, if it's a valuable trait, to actually then take to a genomic selection program. So I'm pretty excited about the fusion, if you like, of these sorts of technologies with genomics.
Yeah, so this is where we are in America now, and I'm sure in there in New Zealand is everyone's talking about big data and how much data are collected on farm, okay? And you're a geneticist and you need phenotypes so you can do your thing, right? You need genotypes and phenotypes. And in the conclusion of your paper, you note that, well, you know, we can handle this. It would be helpful if people record how they bred that cow. Okay, that would make your life a lot easier. Okay, you know, good luck with that one, Jenny. You know,
absolutely.
Anyways, good luck with that one. You know, I think really what you got there in Australia is the guy only brings the bull over once a week. So you think it's timed AI, but it's really the bull only visits once a week. Is that possible?
That's true, actually, because what we did find was that Thursday was the most popular day for synchronization programs. So that was the day that the bull came out.
I got to bring the bull over. So, the deal is, in America, trying to get these companies, you know, if you just talk about activity collars and all the different, you know, tremendous amount of data being collected, but try to get anyone to get that data in a similar format so that it could be used. You know, you must be in the same place in Australia as these companies. It's all proprietary. They don't want to share. And they don't want, and so what do you think? Is it ever going to happen?
I hope so. I'm still pretty optimistic, and I share your concern with the different formats and those sorts of challenges, because I think that's the biggest hurdle we need to get over. But I guess we're not really competing in the genetic space. We're trying to do something different with that data and just use it for a different purpose. So this is the dialogue I've been having with many of those big companies, and they seem quite receptive to that and very willing to work with us. Having said that, we're probably in the same place as many US researchers who are trying to do is the same kind of thing, that actually getting that data is a big challenge right now, and you know, going through the different types of systems that farmers use is very, very difficult to overcome. But I hope that it's going to be some of these fertility traits that are the early traits that we can actually work on in this manner, because they are a bit more consistent, and the sort of data that hopefully is being generated is estrus, for example, expression of estrus.
Yeah, you talk about, for example, embryonic loss, right? And so And of course, as you know, if you have cows on collars, activity collars, and you get a good, strong estrus signal today, and 21 days later, she comes back in estrus with a good, strong signal. Okay, that's one thing. But if she comes back in estrus 35 days later or 34 days later, you know, you can begin to make some assumptions about embryonic loss. In particular, if she comes in and But as you know, when you talk about colors, it strengths a signal. There's a lot that goes into phenotyping other than, oh, she's in heat. And as you know, with colors, it's well, is she really in heat? You know, but nonetheless, if you kill it with data, and if you got 5 million records, right, all that error sort of goes away, you know, and you can make progress.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key, really, is to try and we're obviously very much being driven by what farmers capture in
Yeah.
notebooks and transfer to their computers or
Yeah.
directly into their phone or whatever they do. But, you know, to actually move to a much more objective way of collecting this data has got to be a
Yeah,
positive
yeah.
thing.
So more later then. We will see. We will see. You're younger than me, so it might happen in your lifetime, okay? I don't know, me personally, okay? I don't know. But it comes to a point in your career where it's like, ugh, you know, somebody else could deal with all this stuff. So anyways, we're gonna move on. So for you those that are new to the podcast, which is everybody, because this is the first time we've done it. So to everybody, this is a section of the podcast where we go through some recent articles that caught our eye, and we hope that they are sort of they don't have to be dairy, but they got to be dairy related. And so what we do is Jenny sent me a paper, I sent Jenny a paper, and I'll start, Jenny, because I'll just start. Okay, so I sent Jenny this paper. It appeared in Nature, 27th of October, 2022, a saturated map of common genetic variants associated with human height. Okay, so this is people. This is GWAS in people. And it caught my eye because I don't know what's going on in Australia or wherever. Okay, but in America, you know, cows are huge, right? Dairy cows in America are huge. For many, many years, we only waited on production. And if you only wait on production and nothing else, you end up with a big cow, at least in America. Now, I don't know about Australia, but in America, you get a big cow because there's a correlation between size and milk production. Okay, now I don't know. That's probably only in America where they all get to. We bring the food to them. They can eat as much food as they want all day long. Okay. Maybe in Australia, the big cows die. I don't know. But in America, there's this interest in size, animal size in dairy. Now, Jenny, if you look, you need to do a Google search. You look at cows in America in the 1950s. Okay. And you look how tall they are, right? They come up to like the middle of your chest. They were not very big animals. And of course, now, you know, typically the cow's hooks and pins are about shoulder height for me, big animals, you know. So, and of course, as you also know, I'm sure it's true in Australia, but we now have a slight negative selection pressure on size in America. I don't know if it's height, it's my body weight or whatever, but we're net merit has a tiny negative. We're kind of selecting for smaller cows. I think it has to do with efficiency. Same true in Australia as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Feed efficiency is a big focus in our
Yeah,
breeding programs.
and so we're after a smaller cow, but at the World Dairy Expo, the tallest cow always wins. So there you go. Okay, you know, you're an old cow breeder, so you know about that, right? But anyway, so I looked at this, I thought, wow, 5.4 million people in this study of height, you know, and now you tell me that's not even that big a GWAS. Is that true or not? That's not a big GWAS, 5.4 million people.
No, that is a big GWAS. That is a very big
That
GWAS,
is.
yes. Yeah. But you need that kind of scale to be able to accurately identify, if you like, the genes or the variants that are controlling the trait.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges that we have, obviously, with dairy cattle is assembling those big data sets. There was a study a few years ago that Anik Boumen led, and that was a very big international study bringing together stature data and cattle from
Yeah,
all around the
yeah.
world.
So just so you know, I forgot to mention this. Do you know that the lead author of this paper is from Australia?
You know, I did have a flick through the paper, and I noticed that rather than a Manhattan plot, they were talking about a Brisbane plot. So I,
that makes sense. Yeah. So Loic Yengo, okay. She is from the Institute of Molecular Bioscience, University of Queensland in Brisbane. Okay. And other authors, there's an author, Andrew Wood. So there's a total of 629 authors on this paper.
Wow.
Okay. So there's a high correlation between a number of people in the study and the number of authors. 629 authors. The lead authors are Loic Yengo, Andrew Wood from Genetics of Complex Traits, College of Medicine and Health, University of Exeter, a guy named Vischer from the Institute of Molecular Biosciences, University of Queensland. Yeah. You know this guy?
I know Peter Vischer very well. He was actually the chair of my PhD committee.
He's one of the corresponding authors of this paper. Okay.
Yeah.
And then
I do know that the group in Brisbane actually.
Yeah. And then Joel Hirschhorn, he's from Harvard Medical. So anyways, and then there's a gentleman, or I'm not sure it's a lady or gentleman from Riken in Japan. So so it struck me the number of individuals. It struck me the number of significant loci, okay, 12,000 loci associated with human height. Is that typical, like height in cattle or milk production? Are you usually looking at 12,000 loci that might control that trait?
Yes. Yeah. And it's, I guess, there's, especially around height, there's been this question for many years about the missing heritability in terms of, you know, how much of the genetic variation can we explain? And because it is a very polygenic trait, that it's affected by a lot of parts of the genome, that we expect there to be a lot of variants that are controlling it. But the tricky bit is to try and identify the ones that have a smaller effect. You know, we're really good at identifying the ones that have a large effect, and it's the ones that have a small effect that are really difficult to identify. And that's why we need these very big data sets to be able to pinpoint those variants.
12,000, over 12,000 variants of controlling height, you know, and this is one of the things, you know, there are some low hanging fruit here and there, but I think it's always important to remember that there's a tremendous number of loci that are involved in these complex traits, you know, and it's not as simple as people think. But having said that, Jenny, are you ready? Okay. So you may or may not know this, but I'm a big growth hormone IGF-1 guy, okay? And so I've always been interested in growth hormone and IGF-1. And I just want to say that on this list of 12,000 genes, okay, the IGF-1 receptor ranks 14th in terms of the amount of genetic variation that is explained. 14th, okay, out of 12,000. IGF-1 gene, 38th out of 12,000. Growth hormone, 54th out of 12,000, okay? Growth hormone receptor, 185th out of 12,000. And growth hormone receptor, or growth hormone releasing hormone, 225, okay? So don't talk to me about your FGF-17 beta, okay? The big dogs are on the top of this list, which I thought was great, okay? I thought was great, you know? And so I really enjoyed that paper and sort of, I was really happy that the stuff I study is right at the top of that kind of list. And it gives you some, it makes sense, right? I mean, it makes sense, you know, if you talk about giantism in humans or dwarfism in humans. I mean, these are typically, you know, just ends of the phenotypic spectrum, but we know that they are often explained by mutations within these endocrine systems. So, you know.
Yeah. The cool thing as well, Matt, is obviously because we share so much of our genome with dairy cows, that you would expect many of those to feature high in dairy cow stature or cattle stature.
I don't know if we've done work on that, have we?
So, you know, I did a paper about a decade ago looking trying to figure out which genes are in common between those that have been found at the time
Oh,
for
wow.
human stature and dairy cow stature. Yeah, somebody needs to do that kind of study again, I think, now that we've got these sorts of scale. So there's an idea for somebody to take a look at that particular
So we'll leave
questions.
that
Yeah.
for somebody else, you know? So it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of great questions in
Yeah.
science, and good science makes more
Yeah.
great questions. And so you have to be brave and you have to work hard, but it's a great time to be in science. You know, it's a great time to be in
Yes,
science.
absolutely. And somebody may have already done that and add a comment to our
Oh, I'm
podcast
sure there'll be a lot of
in the
comments. Okay.
newspaper. Exactly.
Great. Okay. So anyways, Jenny sent me a paper, and Jenny, I'm going to let you describe what you were looking at. It's on inbreeding depression in a species of bird in New Zealand. And tell me about what you liked about this paper.
That's right. I'm going to start off with the last time I was in New Zealand, which was just before the COVID pandemic started. In fact, it's literally in the airport when things were going haywire, with a few colleagues actually from the US wondering how they were going to get home. And it was part of a trip with Dairy NZ, and we'd been to Zealandia in Wellington, which has got a pest-proof fence around it and lots of, you know, beautiful indigenous species there. This study was done on an island, which I believe you've been to, Mac.
Teritiri
It's on my list of places to go because it sounds absolutely awesome. The paper I chose is published in Molecular Ecology, probably one of the few papers I've read in Molecular Ecology. It's Genomic Signatures of Inbreeding Depression for a Threatened Aotearoa New Zealand Passerine. And the lead author is Laura Dunch, who has just completed her PhD at University of Auckland. So it's nice that we're staying in the Southern Hemisphere for this. And the senior author is Anna Sanchur from University of Auckland. With a collaboration with an institute in Paris and also one in London as well.
So tell us what they found.
Yeah, the reason I chose the paper and one of the key points, I guess, of the paper is that they had applied a method that we very commonly use in animal breeding to assess recent versus older inbreeding. And this is using an approach called runs of homozygosity. And what a run of homozygosity is you look for stretches of the DNA where you can see that the same part has been inherited from mum as dad. Now, these little birds called hihi birds, there are 363 of them, which they used in their study, and they genotyped with a custom 45K SNP panel. The birds were actually introduced to the island in 1995, and it seemed to be that it must have been quite a small population at the time, although they didn't say exactly how many there were. But when they did a census in 2021, there were only about 192. So this is a very small population. The interesting thing, and what links it quite nicely to what we've been talking about so far, is they actually assessed the relationship between these inbreeding traits, these runs of homozygosity, and traits that are associated with either survival or reproductive success. So they looked at annual reproductive success, annual survival as an adult, and then this juvenile survival trait, which is whether they survive to two census counts. What they found, I think, was really interesting that, first of all, there were some massive stretches of runs of homozygosity. So, for example, on one individual, they found that 60% of chromosome one was a run of homozygosity. That's absolutely massive.
Oh my
Yes,
gosh.
exactly. That indicates, you know, recent inbreeding when you see a huge stretch of homozygosity like that. And they worked out that Most of the inbreeding had occurred in the last 10 generations, which is not really surprising. They also found these poor little birds don't last very long. So the average lifespan is only 3.16 years. And most of the losses are actually in that very early period. So if you ignore the ones that are lost in early life, they last to about 4.4 years. And the trait that does seem to be most sensitive to inbreeding is this juvenile survival trait, which is quite interesting. So if they can manage to last that early period of life, then they're pretty safe, is my take on it. But if they are inbred, they're much less likely to survive that
so you period. Sense that in dairy? Any evidence for that in dairy, that survival through weaning, for example, is more influenced by inbreeding than some other things?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's probably hard to say at the moment that we do see a lot of traits that are sensitive to inbreeding. But it seems that the production traits, well, my take on it at this point is that the production traits seem to be just as sensitive as the fertility traits or the survival traits. But it probably, again, this is an area that I think is growing in importance. I think that inbreeding is one of the big challenges that we have in the dairy population. You know, estimates of effective population size are typically around about 50 or so, or even less. So, and you compare that to humans, where it's in the thousands, possibly tens of thousands, not entirely sure. But, you know, we do have a big issue in terms of inbreeding and ways that we can manage that. And, you know, I think there are different players who have an important role here, you know, farmers to actually, I suppose, manage the inbreeding at the end point. But we need researchers to quantify the issue. And then hopefully either genetic evaluation units or AI companies to help provide those sorts of solutions. There are solutions out there already. You know, there's a lot of attention being paid to the space. I think it's of increasing importance that we really pay attention to it, because the flip side of genomic selection and increasing the rate of genetic gain is that we are seeing higher rates of inbreeding. So it's a really important issue right now.
I know that, as you know, Jenny, that the role that genetics is going to play in species conservation in the future is going to increase, right? And I know you're well aware that there's a lot of genetics that goes on among zoo populations and attempting to maintain species. And as the certain populations are depleted, of course, it just becomes more and more important. And I guess if someone's interested in a interesting area is, you know, perhaps in dairy, we have some capacity with frozen semen to bring back some genetics that might have been around 100 years or 50 years ago, maybe. But and you know, and you understand as well as I do the difficulties in even going that direction. But wouldn't it be fascinating if there was some way to reintroduce safely genetic variation into these species, you know, to sort of revive their genomes in a manner that doesn't kill them? But unfortunately, I think we would only have very blunt tools to reintroduce genetic variation into some of these species to maybe save them. I mean, I don't think, are you aware of any ways to safely reintroduce, other than breeding to, you know, I don't know.
I think that's a really important point, and it's something that needs very serious consideration, obviously. So just a couple of things I guess I want to pick up on what you said. And the first is that this is the first study using this approach of runs of homozygosity applied to, I guess, the rare or the conservation area. So I think it's going to be more widely used into the future. But I think they did something really smart in New Zealand when they set up these sanctuaries. And it was obviously very intentional that they've got different populations. So they can actually bring birds from one population to another and, you know, reinvigorate by having two different inbred populations actually giving you new diversity. So those are important strategies, I think.
We're going to finish now, Jenny, with a few questions. And I'm sure I've tired you out, and now you have a full day of to work. See, we're at the end of the day here in America, so I get to go home and, I don't know, go to sleep or something. But you have to keep working, okay? And so no taking the rest of the day off, okay, because you survive your podcast, okay? So the final questions for the speaker. Do you have any favorite people, living or dead, science or no science, that inspired you in your career? Any favorite people?
I mentioned a few of the key ones earlier on, actually. So, you know, the late Professor Bill Hill was a great inspiration to me. A lot of my mentors in Edinburgh, you know, that was a really special time of my life. And then to come over here and work with the rock stars of genomics, Ben Hayes and Mike Goddard, was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of men.
It's okay. Things are changing. And maybe I'm not in Australia, but in America, We're training a lot of women scientists. Any really good science career advice that you can give or you got along the way from someone else?
Yeah. Okay. This is one that Jeff Sim, who is another of my PhD supervisors, gave me. And I tried it and it was really hard, but it's good if you can do it. And that's to always, if you're trying to increase your publication record, try and have a paper that you have in preparation and one that you have submitted or in press at the same time, so that you keep that cycle going. And it actually worked really effectively for me. It does put a lot of self-pressure on, but it's a really fantastic way to increase your publication record.
And you write excellent papers, and it is good advice. I remember I'm not as good now, but early in my career, that was always my goal, have something into a journal at all times. I know that you're one of our most prolific JDS authors. You published in JDS Communications yet or no? Yeah, you did, didn't you? You sent me something.
Yes.
A couple of papers, yeah?
I think so, yes. Yes, a couple of papers.
Yeah, you need to keep, You send me more, okay? Please send me more, all right? I like that. And then that's one thing we find with JDS Communications is we get a lot of JDS authors, and most of the people that submit to us I'm very familiar with. So that's been really good. If you were not a scientist, Jenny, okay, what would you be doing? It sounds like you would be breeding dairy cattle somewhere. True or false?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this was the hardest question, Matt, because I love what I do. I'd probably be a sire analyst for a breeding company. So helping to pick genetics for the next generation of bulls.
Yeah, I always feel, you know, because we deal with a lot of young people here and you know, they're university students. And I always tell them, you know, I was lucky. It sounds like you were lucky. You find your passion and we're the lucky ones, right? It's always hard when students have trouble finding what their passions are, you know, but when you find it, and if it's a good fit, you know, you're the luckiest person. I always tell people, I like going to work. I don't know. I like going to work. I think it's fun. You know, it's interesting, right? You have your bad days and you have your good days, but I don't know. I like going to work.
I just want to echo the same sentiment, really, that I feel very privileged to be in the position that I'm in. And, you know, there's been a lot of hard work along the way, but a lot of good fortune in, you know, taking the opportunities when they're there and working with great people. And a lot of that has come to me, and I'm just immensely grateful for what's happened in my career.
I would just like to say thank you, Jenny, for being our very first Dairy Digressions person.
You're welcome.
And it has been just a tremendous pleasure to speak with you today. This has been the Dairy Digressions podcast with Dr. Matt Lucy and Dr. Jenny Price. If you liked what you heard or would like to give us some feedback, please do so by ADSA at ADSA.org. And if you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate us on whatever platform you are listening on. So Jenny, again, thank you very much. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome.